Ted Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brownhill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. On today's edition, we take a look back at some of the important legal stories of the past year. Our host, Attorney Robin Martinez, has been working with groups in North Dakota fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. He is joined by local criminal defense attorney Eric Vernon, who will look at some of the ballot initiatives passed in the last election and more. You can submit your nominations on our Facebook page or call in. We will pass them along to our guests in the second part of the show. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Stay tuned for Robin and Eric.
Good morning. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney in Kansas City and a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI Community Radio. Here with me today is Eric Vernon, a local criminal defense attorney, and Eric and I will be discussing a number of topics this morning. What we want to do is give you a little bit of a wrap-up and an overview of some of the very important and some of the most important legal stories that occurred over the past year. I think January is a good time to step back and take a little bit of a retrospective. So that's what we're hoping to do for you today. Just as a kind of a roadmap, I'm going to go a little bit into one of the key kind of environmental fights that's been happening over the last year and that continues to unfold this year as well, and that's the battle over the Keystone XL pipeline. Then Eric's going to give us an overview of some very significant changes that are happening here in the state of Missouri. The Missouri completely revamped its criminal code, which is going to take effect, I believe, in 2017, and he'll go into some of those issues. And then after that, he and I will talk about some of the more important Supreme Court decisions that were that were made by the U.S. Supreme Court over the last year. Welcome to the show, Eric. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me, Robin.
One of the things that I guess we'll start with the Keystone XL pipeline case that's been in the news quite a bit. There's a major company out of Canada, TransCanada, that is planning on building this pipeline to transport oil from the Canadian tar sands in Alberta all the way down to refineries along the U.S. Gulf Coast. And if you've been reading the news, there's a big showdown right now between the U.S. Congress and the White House over the permitting for that pipeline. Because it crosses a national border, the border with Canada, the pipeline has to receive a presidential thumbs up. And whether or not President Obama will actually give it a thumbs up or will deny their permitting still remains to be seen, regardless of what Congress is going to do or not. But in the meantime, a couple of very important sort of legal developments have been unfolding with that case. First, in the state of Nebraska, one of the reasons that President Obama was holding up his decision on permitting for the pipeline was because the Nebraska Supreme Court had been holding off on a decision as to whether or not the pipeline would be permitted through Nebraska. And Nebraska is a pretty important state for that because TransCanada wants to put the pipeline through an environmentally sensitive area called the Sand Hills, which if there was a major pipeline spill or any kind of leak or disaster occurring with that pipeline in that region, it would have a major significant effect on the entire watershed and water and all the water resources of that area of Nebraska, and frankly would render a good portion of that region. I think it would make it very, very difficult for people to live there with that type of contamination. So anyway, what's happened is this last week, the Nebraska Supreme Court finally issued its decision, and they kind of passed the buck. They basically said they didn't have the ability to render a decision because the landowners who brought the lawsuit originally lacked standing, which is an important legal principle that says you have to essentially have some skin in the game, and the court said that that had not occurred yet. So stay tuned and see what happens in Nebraska. That's a story that's still unfolding. Now, the second thing that's going on legally is that there's also a battle currently underway in South Dakota, which is another state that the Keystone XL pipeline is slated to go through. One of the reasons I haven't been on Jaws of Justice that much lately has been I've been involved in representing one of the parties that's been granted intervener status in the case that's currently pending in front of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. And under South Dakota law, Keystone XL and TransCanada have to recertify their construction permits for the pipeline through that state. And so we have a number of landowners, small family farmers and ranchers, whose land will be affected by the pipeline, who are challenging that permitting. And for the first time in quite a long time, virtually all the major Indian tribes in South Dakota have actually all united, and they've managed to lawyer up, and they're all challenging TransCanada as well in front of the Public Utilities Commission. We're set to go for a hearing in May. Should be about a two-week hearing. It's going to be an interesting battle to watch that unfold. So stay tuned. Lots happening with the Keystone XL pipeline. A final note, there's a not-for-profit environmental organization, 360.org, that has a rally planned in Kansas City to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. And that is, I believe, taking place Tuesday, which is tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the evening down at the J.C. Nichols Fountain. So that's a local event that is going on to help protest the pipeline. So that's what's happening in the area of environmental law, and something that really affects us here throughout the Midwest. But let's sort of switch gears a little bit. And Eric, why don't you tell us something about the changes that were made by the Missouri legislature this year to Missouri's criminal code. Is it a pretty significant or sweeping change?
Well, it's a sweeping change in the sense that it's the first time that they've revamped and reorganized since the 70s. Back in the 70s, we passed the Missouri criminal code, and we classified most crimes as one class of felony or another, and each class of felony has a certain sentence of imprisonment that can go with it that defines its classification. And over the decades, the legislatures have fiddled and created new laws and new statutes and new crimes with all kinds of their own special sentencing provisions buried in them, and it's become kind of a complex system. So over the last 7 or 8 years, committees from the legislature and the Missouri Bar have gotten together and worked on trying to bring it all back into a more cohesive and organized code. One of the things they did do, in addition to just cleaning the code up, one of the changes they've made is they've created a new class of felony. So for the last 30, 40 years, there were three classes of felonies, or four classes, A, B, C, D, and a D felony was up to 4 years in prison. For a C felony, you could get up to 7 years in prison. And for a B felony, you had a minimum of 5 up to 15 years in prison. So they've added a new felony.
And what have they added?
And they've added, now a C felony is going to be a minimum of 3 years up to 10 years. So you still have the E felony is now going to be what the D felony was. So the E felony is going to be 0 to 4 years. The D felony is going to be the old C felony, and now the C felony is going to be 3 years to 10 years. And the idea being given prosecutors and judges and defense counsel more possibilities to fashion, the appropriate remedy to work things out, as it were, to do plea bargains and that kind of thing.
So was that seen as maybe giving a little bit more flexibility when it came to sentencing them perhaps as well?
Yes, yes. Okay. There's some other just updating the code in the sense of raising some of the dollar amounts. In the past, to be a felony stealing, you had to steal more than $500 worth of property, and they're going to raise that to $750. There's some other things. Fines are changing. The fines are doubling. Instead of your basic felony, you could be fined up to $5,000. Now you can be fined up to $10,000. And that pretty much everything's doubled for misdemeanors too. Significantly, the drug laws are being changed. For some reason, this has always driven me crazy. The drug, possession of controlled substance, distributing controlled substance, trying to get Sudafed or whatever, all those have been buried in Chapter 195, which is about prescription drugs. Now we're creating a criminal statute just for possession and distribution and manufacture of controlled substances. And one of the big changes there, too, is going to be that we're creating an e-misdemeanor, which can only have up to a $300 fine, and that e-misdemeanor is going to apply to possession of less than 5 grams of marijuana. So for the next couple of years, if you possessed more than 35 grams of marijuana, you could be charged with a felony. If you possess less than 35 grams, you could be charged with an e-misdemeanor, which is up to a year in jail. In 2 years, if you just had a little bit, like 2 or 3 grams worth, you can only be charged with a D misdemeanor. The other thing is there's throughout the statutes right now, there's places where individual statutes say if you've done this before, if you've been convicted of this before, your sentence can be enhanced. And they're all kind of confused and different and individual. And this new change is going to try and take it back to all the enhancement statutes are going to be the same. So if you're a prior drug offender, you're going to be your sentence enhancement would be the same as if you're a prior felony stealer. And sentence enhancement means, so if you've been a felony drug possessor in the past and you were a D felon, if the prosecutor wanted to charge you that way, you could look at the C felony range of punishment. So instead of 0 to 7 years, if you've got a prior conviction, you could be sentenced up to 10 years in prison under the new C felonies. And again, none of this actually goes into effect until 2017. I think the governor was actually reluctant to sign the bill. The legislature was frustrated because they'd been working on it for so long, and it actually passed both houses and went to the governor, and finally the governor signed it. And I think one of the reasons he said he went ahead and signed it is because it doesn't go into effect for 2 years. It'll give everybody time to study it and look at it and see if there's changes that need to be made.
So what was the governor's reluctance?
He's a very law enforcement, pro law enforcement guy. You know, he was attorney general for many, many years, and I think he was just afraid that there were mistakes made or things that were going to let people get off somehow. That was kind of the impression I got. It's been a while since I actually read his statement, but he did indicate that he was concerned that we were going to make it harder to convict people or that people would get away with crimes, and so he wanted to have time to – but he was glad about the 2 years to be able to have time to review.
Now, the downgrading of the marijuana possession seems actually fairly significant for Missouri. Would you say that that's the case?
I would say. I'm not sure how significant it is, because the practicality of the matter is a lot of municipalities and some of the county, state courts, prosecutors almost decriminalize small amounts of marijuana already. I mean, there's a lot of places where a defense attorney can get a marijuana charge if it's a small amount, and if the defendant, you know, cooperated and was polite to the police officers and everything. There's a lot of places where that can turn into a $300 littering charge. So it's, to some extent, it's recognizing the reality of, you know, public perception of the criminality of possessing a marijuana cigarette.
Now, there are a couple of ballot initiatives, though, that are planned for the 2016 election here in Missouri. I believe one would actually decriminalize marijuana, and then I believe there may be another one that's looking towards legalizing it for medical use as well. How would, for instance, if a ballot initiative, let's say the voters of the state were to pass that, what effect would that have on this new legislation?
Well, one would think that would overrule the marijuana portions of the new legislation. So, yeah, I mean, if the ballot initiative legalizes or decriminalizes marijuana, then I would imagine that would trump the current statutes or even the planned statute. There were a couple of other ballot initiatives that did pass this past year. if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Mentioning real briefly here. One of the bigger ones for the concern of criminal defense attorneys and I think excited prosecutors was this ballot initiative about using prior allegations of misdeeds as evidence in sex cases. You know, you probably remember from law school, Robin, that typically character evidence is not admitted in criminal cases unless the defendant injects the issue.
That's right.
So traditionally, we have not wanted to convict people because you are a certain kind of person. You know, the question is has always been, did you commit this particular crime? Not, are you the kind of person that commits that kind of crime? And so you're not allowed, so prosecutors are not allowed to, in any case, say, you know, if somebody's accused of stealing, say, well, he's stolen before, so he's a stealer, so probably he stole this time, because that's not really logically or legally relevant. And so that's been a big issue for prosecutors and victims' rights activists in the sex crimes area, especially when you're dealing with kids.
But we had a constitutional amendment that addressed this head on.
That's right.
And it actually won by a fairly wide margin here in Missouri, didn't it?
It sure did.
A little bit about that.
And so the amendment says that from now on, in prosecutions of crimes of a sexual nature involving a victim under 18, so if the victim is a child, relevant evidence of prior criminal acts, whether charged or uncharged, is admissible for the purpose of corroborating the victim's testimony or demonstrating the defendant's propensity to commit the crime. So there's a couple of things in there. One is, like I said, it's specifically authorizing courts to allow propensity evidence. This is the kind of guy that touches kids. So in fact, there's a current, for years and years and years, there's been a jury instruction in the state of Missouri where jurors are, if a defendant takes the witness stand to challenge his credibility, the state can say, haven't you been convicted of a crime before? Prior convictions are relevant for credibility, but there's a jury instruction that tells the jury, you're not allowed to consider that as propensity evidence. You're not allowed to consider, okay, this guy is a stealer or this guy is a child molester.
Now, that's a pretty fine line, though, because, I mean, don't you think a lot of jurors, even if they're instructed that way and they hear the evidence of the prior conviction, I mean, that's going to bias them in a lot of respects, don't you think?
Oh, sure. And that's a fear. And that's one of those realities where, you know, if somebody has a prior conviction for a sex crime, typically they're – you're not going to see him take the witness stand. It is difficult for somebody to believe, it's difficult for lawyers to believe that a jury is actually going to be able to follow the law and not consider that as propensity evidence. And so yeah, there is that has actually been a reason for a criminal defendant not to take the stand if they've got a conviction in their past. But the other significant thing about this is not only are they going to be able to allowed to use those convictions for propensity evidence, they're not going to get that instruction anymore, but it refers to uncharged, charged or uncharged, not just convictions, but charged or uncharged. So, you know, if a young man is accused of a bad touch on one young on a child, and the neighbors or the police come up with, oh well, there was this other kid who 2 years ago said that something happened, but nobody really believed them, or we investigated and decided it didn't happen, or it got charged, and then after a trial it got dismissed because the jury found him not guilty. Well, doesn't matter. Now, according to this, the state will be able to bring that up in the new prosecution. They'll be able to use this uncharged or even, I mean, I suppose, according to the, you know, charged or uncharged, even if you were acquitted of by a jury, you know, a year ago, they could be used in a new trial.
What about rumor and innuendo?
Well,
to me, it seems that it opens the door to to just simply anybody being able to come out of the woodwork and saying, hey, I think this guy's a child molester because he may have hit an, you know, he may have acted inappropriately with another minor.
Well, exactly.
And so does that come in then?
Well, and that'll be our judges are going to be challenged over the next few years to decide what's going to come in, and I'm sure there will be many battles in trial courts that will be decided by appellate courts and eventually the Missouri Supreme Court, deciding exactly how far down this hole we're going to go in a trial, because you know judges have to be concerned about trials within trials. You know, if we were trying this one, you know, child molesting case, and now there's three others they want to talk about in that one child molesting case, and how much evidence should they be allowed to bring it up, and if they do bring it up, how much defense do we get to, or should we have to do to these uncharged acts? So it'll be very interesting over the next few years.
Do you have any particular thoughts about how this is going to play out over the next few years, and how courts may ultimately take a look at this new constitutional amendment?
I do not. I'm gonna sit back and, well, I'm not gonna sit back and watch. I imagine I'll be engaged in some of these battles. You know, you're gonna have judges who are gonna say, I don't want to have trials within trials. This is still not legally relevant. And you're gonna have prosecutors seeking writs with the Court of Appeals. You're going to have people convicted based on rumor and innuendo, and you're going to have them appealing their cases, and it will be interesting developments.
It's going to be quite the free-for-all almost, yeah, in many respects.
Yes.
So what other were there, besides this one particular constitutional amendment, were there any other key ballot initiatives that over the past year that have a major effect on our justice system?
Well, the only other one that I think may have some impact on our justice system is the Right to Bear Arms Amendment, Amendment 5. And, you know, we should probably in the future call a gun rights attorney down here to talk about this in detail. What it says is, and again, it passed fairly successfully. It says,
well, Missouri's a pretty pro-Second Amendment
that's
state,
right.
I think, in the big picture.
That's right. And so it says that the right of every citizen to keep and bear arms, ammunition, and accessories typical to the normal function of such arms in defense of his home, person, family, and property shall not be questioned. The rights guaranteed by this section shall be unalienable. And it goes on to talk about requiring courts and legislatures to subject to strict scrutiny any law that is going to be used to restrict those rights. Strict scrutiny being a legal term of art about constitutional rights.
You sort of preempted me there. I was going to ask you specifically what is meant by strict scrutiny, because that's actually a very important buzzword when it comes to evaluating legal decisions and
right.
Evaluating legal principles. What do you mean by strict scrutiny?
Well, so that means, you know, that from now on, if the legislature wants to pass a statute having anything to do with guns or ammunition or other accessories that are required, the courts are supposed to, based on this, overturn or not uphold those statutes if they are not serving a significant state interest and it is not the most narrowly constructed statute to fulfill that purpose.
So that's a very, very high standard then.
Right. It's very high. It's the highest standard in constitutional law.
Well, I guess it's not terribly surprising given the politics in Missouri that we would have, such an amendment passed so very handily, I think being pushed by the Second Amendment lobby.
Oh, yeah.
You are listening to Jaws of Justice here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. We're going to take a short break for some public service announcements, and I believe our Jaws of Justice calendar that's coming up. Eric Vernon and I, this is Robin Martinez, a member of the National Lawyers Guild in Kansas City. We'll be back after the break.
And now the calendar for the week of January 12th, 2015. The Homeless Task Force has multiple meetings scheduled this month, and you are encouraged to get involved with their efforts to implement their strategy to end homelessness in the greater Kansas City area. The Housing Locator Summit will be Wednesday, January 21st, 1 to 4:30 p.m. The next day, Thursday, January 22nd, the Coordinated Outreach Session and Training will be from 12 noon to 3 p.m. And the Empowerment Project Team will meet 3 to 4:30 p.m. All meetings will be at the Mid-America Regional Council Office, 600 Broadway, Suite 200, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information on these and other projects of the Homelessness Task Force, contact Jason Bohn, that's B-O-H-N, at 816-701-8256, or email jbohn@marc.org. Give Yourself Real Love is sponsoring a hands-off domestic violence forum Saturday, January 24th, 2 p.m. at the Buford Library, 3050 Prospect, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be giving the GYRL Annual Awards out from 1:30 to 2 p.m. Guest speakers will include KC Police Deputy Chief Hopkins, Pastor Kay Smith, Minister Keith Brown, not to be confused with the Keith Brown Ill here on Jaws of Justice Radio, and State Representative Brandon Ellington. The hands-off forum will begin at 2 p.m. If you want to meet with others who are outraged by the police killings of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Antonio Martin, and other people of color, there is a demonstration daily at 7 p.m. on the corner of Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard and Prospect. You can make your own sign or use one provided. My name is Keith Brown Hill, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
Welcome back. This is Robin Martinez, a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm here today with Attorney Eric Vernon on Jaws of Justice Radio, KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio station. Right before the break, we were talking about the constitutional amendment that was passed in the state of Missouri that really expanded and I think further enshrined our Second Amendment gun rights. And one of the interesting things that I think may come from this particular decision is that, and this particular constitutional amendment, is that right now a lot of felons are precluded from having or possessing firearms. So if we now have, Eric, a constitutional amendment that makes the exercise of gun rights here in the state of Missouri so much more significant, how does that jive with restrictions on the rights of felons to either have or not have guns?
Right. Well, and again, we're waiting to see. We're waiting with bated breath. The Missouri Supreme Court currently has a case pending before it where that argument was made. The amendment actually says, it kind of addresses it, but it changes it a little bit. It says, nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent the General Assembly from enacting general laws which limit the rights of convicted violent felons or those duly adjudged mentally infirmed by the court of competent jurisdiction. So they insert this word violent felon, and it, you know, without any definition, so nobody's quite sure what exactly that means at this point. But there is a case before the Missouri Supreme Court where a fellow was charged with being a felon in possession, and his predicate felony, the felony that makes him a felon in possession, so to speak, was a drug felony, a possession of drugs. And his lawyer argued to the Missouri Supreme Court, you know, that's unconstitutional now because he's, you know, there's nothing violent about possessing narcotics. And again, so that's pending right now. I my read of the article that I read about it was that the Missouri Supreme Court was not impressed, and I think it may have to do with legal theories about the law has been on the books for a while, and I don't know.
Exactly. Not impressed by the defense attorney's argument, or yeah, not impressed yeah. by the prosecution?
Which, no, it sounded, it sounded like they were not impressed by the defense attorney's arguments.
Well, that presents a really sort of interesting philosophical clash, though, between a lot of the sort of the conservative view that that gun rights are sacred versus the, you know, this almost also, you know, likewise conservative impulse to try to punish people.
Oh yeah.
So it's an interesting bit of cognitive dissonance. Do you know when the Supreme Court may wind up the Missouri Supreme Court may wind up issuing a ruling on this particular case?
I do not. They had arguments second week of December, so who knows? It could be, I mean, usually typically they take at least a month or two, and sometimes as much as 6 or 8 months before they get around to issuing a decision, so we'll see.
So I guess the story is stay tuned then, and we'll see what happens with the interpretation of this latest gun rights constitutional amendment here in Missouri.
There you go.
Well, that's been pretty much what's happened in the state of Missouri. Why don't we shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about the national level and some of the key Supreme Court decisions that were issued by the U.S. Supreme Court over the last year and during 2014. There were quite a number of them that covered a lot of different ground. And why don't we start with one of the that's maybe gotten a lot of play in the press, and that was the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby case. What was that case all about, Eric? Do you have a? Could you give us just maybe a one liner what it was about?
Right. Well, that was a challenge to the to a provision in the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And the challenge was based on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act requires if an employer is going to have insurance for its employees, the insurance had to cover contraceptives. And Hobby Lobby claims that they have a corporate religious objection to certain kinds of contraception. And I'm not real knowledgeable about all the details. I think it has to do with abortifacients or something. But in any case, they have a religious corporate objection to certain kinds of contraceptives, and they thought it violated their First Amendment right to be required to pay for contraceptives that they disagreed with.
So it's really almost, in many respects, an extension of this notion of corporate personhood. Corporations now have the right to exercise their First Amendment rights in terms of freedom of religion. Is that how this is being seen?
That's the way it looks to me. I think it was somewhat narrowly tailored. I think the court made a big point of saying we're talking about closely held corporations, where you could maybe actually make the argument that indeed a very small, tightly knit group of people own the corporation. It's not publicly traded, and so maybe they do have some religious rights as a corporation. But basically, I guess some corporations are now have First Amendment religious rights.
Well, and that's what I found was interesting about that decision in particular was how they tried to narrowly tailor it to what they called close corporations. Now, one of the things, though, that I thought was really sort of fascinating about that discussion was that the court really didn't seem to focus so much on the size of the corporation, but really more or less who was in control of it. So my take on this particular case is that if you have a large publicly traded corporation like, you know, General Motors or General Electric or, you know, ExxonMobil, that this decision's not really going to be able to do that very much for those companies in terms of allowing them to, quote, exercise their First Amendment religious rights. But on the other hand, there are some very large corporations out here in this country that are closely held. Prime example here in Kansas City, Hallmark. It is a very large corporation, but it by all means is practically family owned. So I guess the question that you have then is Hallmark able to exercise its First Amendment rights? Or another good example are the Koch brothers. The Koch Industries is a closely held corporation. Does Koch Industries now suddenly have an argument under this case that, let's say, that environmental regulations, for instance, violate their First Amendment rights from a religious standpoint because they're religiously opposed to having a clean environment?
Right.
There are a lot of, I think, troubling implications from this particular decision.
Or what if your particular corporate employer doesn't believe in blood transfusions for some reason. Does that mean that then the insurance you get from your employer is not going to allow for the payment for blood transfusion that you need to save your life? There's all kinds of interesting questions about how this is going to work out in the future.
Exactly. And when it comes also to this whole notion of sticking with healthcare, it's not just blood transfusions. You've got other, for instance, religious groups that don't believe in any kind of modern medical intercession or vaccinations or anything like that. Are all of their employees suddenly at risk because the owners of that corporation now suddenly choose to say that that because of the Burwell or the Hobby Lobby decision, their First Amendment rights prevent them from having to provide that type of coverage.
Right.
So I guess we'll see where this case goes, but it definitely and certainly seems like it opens a can of worms. And what was kind of funny about this particular case was that it was a very close decision in the Supreme Court. It was a 5-4 decision with, of course, the conservative wing of the court, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, Roberts, and then Kennedy acting as a swing vote here in favor of that. So let's jump to one of the next sort of big cases that came up. And that was the Harris versus Quinn, which the court decided back in June of last year. And this was another 5-4 decision with the four hardcore conservatives plus Kennedy as the swing vote prevailing. And this was a case that that really implicated labor organizing and labor unions. What do you know about this one, Eric?
Not a whole lot. I'm going to probably defer to you a little bit. I know that the rule traditionally has been that if your workplace, including government workplace, is covered by a union, you don't have to pay for the organizing and you don't have to pay for the political speech or lobbying that the union might do. But you do have to pay dues for the other traditional things that you benefit from, the collective bargaining that the union does on your behalf and the grievance representation the union does on your behalf. So you do have to pay traditionally some union dues if you're in a union shop.
And that's largely because of the principle that all employees then benefit, and by not having participation in union dues, essentially you create an opportunity for free riding.
Free riding, right.
In days. Well, what I found interesting about this particular decision was it was a case that originated out of Illinois that related to home health care workers. And Illinois has a very strong provision that essentially says that any sort of public sector employees have to wind up participating in this. And I think it goes back to the idea of the teachers' unions and also police unions and the various other public employee unions. In this case, the court said that there really wasn't, because these home health care workers may sort of be deemed to be public employees because they're being paid by the state Medicaid system. They really weren't, and so they created this odd carve-out of employees they said were not subject to these particular types of rules. And this was, I think, probably the most significant labor decision that came out over the last year. But I don't know to what extent it will have an impact on some of the larger issues.
Right. I did read an article that said that suggested that it wasn't really all that big a decision. It wasn't that great a loss for the unions, but the dissent was suggested that we should be concerned in the future for bigger decisions. The dissent suggested that this might be a harbinger of things to come.
The so-called nose under the camel's tent, or the camel's nose under the tent.
Right.
And more things may come down the pike. Well, let's move a little bit over to one of the First Amendment cases that wound up being decided last year. And there was a big one that came out of Massachusetts that dealt with protests around abortion clinics. And once again, this was it's one of these cases that I would have thought would have been a 5-4 decision, but it really wasn't. It was a 9-0 decision by all the members of the Supreme Court that held that buffer zones that the state of Massachusetts was trying to create around abortion clinics violated the First Amendment. What do you think was the court's rationale for this particular case?
Yeah, I don't know. They talked about the strict scrutiny stuff. They basically said, the state didn't narrowly tailor the restriction. It wasn't a significant enough governmental interest. There were, they suggested that there were other ways that they could address the issues at hand without substantially burdening the petitioner's nonviolent and non-obstructive speech. I had a hard time with it because, growing up in the 80s and 90s, we saw the protests, the abortion protests, the Operation Rescue stuff, and so I have this vision of the abortion protests being anything but nonviolent, but the court in this case acted as if these sidewalk counselors just want to come up and and, you know, just counsel and talk to the poor folks that are going into the abortion clinic. And so really it's not that big a deal. And if you're going to restrict their speech, if you're going to burden their speech, burden their ability to just nicely counsel these poor women, you got to find a less restrictive means of doing it.
That's what one of the things that struck me about this decision as well was that the court did seem, like you said, to rely on the statements of the plaintiffs in the case who claimed that they were just there to, quote, talk quietly to people that were that were coming and seeking family planning or abortion services at the clinics. And so I'm wondering if, you know, if maybe the court turned its turned a blind eye a little bit to the reality of what the anti-abortion movement has actually been doing in terms of its protests in front of clinics. That was a pretty big First Amendment case, and like I said, it was interesting in the terms of it being a 9-0 decision. There were a couple more 9-0 decisions, which I guess is probably big news in and of itself coming out of the Supreme Court. But one of them actually touched a little bit on presidential power this last year. And that was the case also decided back in June, National Labor Relations Board versus Noel Canning. And that case dealt with the president's authority to make to various offices during congressional recess. And I guess this particular decision was important because, of course, Congress has for quite some time now tried to obstruct a lot of presidential appointments to everything from the federal bench to, in this case, it was the National Labor Relations Board. In this case, the during a brief recess of Congress, President Obama made an appointment to the NLRB, and then the court essentially took that on. What happened here in this case, Eric?
I think the dispute was whether or not it was actually a recess, right? But I think what was happening was this was last Christmas or the Christmas before, and the Senate they were doing these pro forma sessions in order to avoid an official 10-day recess. They were doing these pro forma sessions where pretty much everybody went home, but somebody was there and somebody would come and open the session and then a minute later adjourn it, and then they're still in session. And so the president said, well, you know, that's not really – you're not really in session. This is really a recess. Everybody's gone home for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. And so he went ahead and issued the recess appointment. And that was the dispute, was whether or not Congress – I think that was the dispute, was whether or not Congress was really in recess. And I think the court basically said, hey, if they don't want to be in recess, they get to decide whether or not they're in recess. I mean, that's kind of the way I read it.
That's how I read it as well. It was almost more of an affirmation of Congress's own authority to set its own procedures. And consequently, I think that was maybe an interesting point, and maybe that's why it wound up being a 9-0 decision in front of the Supreme Court, was that they were trying to be really cognizant of this notion of the balance of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So, you know, we'll see how that one plays out. I think probably the effects for most people on the ground are probably fairly limited, although it does constrain the president's, you know, authority somewhat.
Right. I'm kind of curious how it's going to impact any decisions the NLRB made in that time span between when the president appointed this guy and you know, when this decision came out. Is he now not appointed? Is he not the chairman or a member of the NLRB?
Well, that's a good point. And are those decisions made during that by the NLRB during the time that he was sitting there? Are those, you know, are those then open to challenge in terms of their validity?
I'm sure somebody's going to challenge it.
So there may indeed be some legal fallout from that. Now let's shift to the next case. That was actually probably one of the most substantial Fourth Amendment cases. That was also a 9-0 decision, and that was Riley versus California. We actually had a previous show just devoted to this particular case because I thought it was such a big deal. Why don't you give us a recap of this one, Eric?
Right. And this is pretty straightforward. You know, the police grabbed they arrested somebody, and they took his phone and the phone was on, and they started going through his contacts and his IMs, his messages, and got evidence off of it. And they challenged that as an unreasonable search of his property. And the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court agreed that, no, you cannot, without a warrant, you can't just take somebody's phone. The police can't just take somebody's phone and start going through it. I mean, that the Supreme Court basically said you have to have a warrant to get into the contents of the phone. So that's, you know, that's good news for individual rights, civil rights in America these days, that you have some protections for what you carry in your phone. In fact, I'll tell you what, I had a recently, this came up in my practice. You know, kids these days occasionally send pictures of themselves unclothed to each other, their boyfriends and girlfriends. And a school recently had a situation where they thought that my client had received one of these pictures, and, you know, if he had, he arguably might have been possessing some child pornography. The young woman's breasts, and she's are on his phone, and she's under the age of 17. You know, arguably that's child pornography, and that's a big old deal. And so they just said, but they didn't. I still to this day don't know why they thought he had it, but they asked for his phone. They said, "We want to see your phone. Give me your phone. I want to look at it." And he said no. He gave him the phone, but he said, no, you can't look at it. And you know what? The police officer that was doing it knew about this law, knew about this case, and she seized the phone, but she went and tried to get a warrant. And I don't know what happened in the background, but a month later we got the phone back.
Did they search it or did they not?
it's
a good question. But, you know, what struck me about the Riley decision in particular was, I think, you know, the Supreme Court's been criticized for years about really not understanding or almost being blind to the realities of modern developments in terms of technology and how technology is being used. And in this case, I think for the first time ever, it seems like that they actually gave a nod to and expressed a little bit of understanding of how people actually use technology in their lives and how connected smartphones are. And the fact that it's not just a device for communicating with somebody else, you know, by voice over the phone, but it contains emails, it contains all of your photos, it contains geolocation data. It can, theoretically, it even connect, your phone even potentially connects with various cloud services that you have. And so a search of one's cell phone can reveal quite a bit about somebody's life that frankly is, you know, for the police to have is just incredibly intrusive.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And as I remember from the reading the decision, that was, you know, the Supreme Court acknowledged that. They did. They were fully aware. And that was one of the issues about the reasonableness of the search, you know, that's not just a phone. It carries all this information about us. It's almost like searching our house.
So that was a really good decision then. It's another one that was 9-0. So kudos to the U.S. Supreme Court for, at least in my mind, getting at least one case right here. Speaking of technology, let's just sort of jump to another kind of technology-related decision that they made over the last year, a case called ABC versus Arrow. And what it was it involved streaming video of broadcast television. And here the Supreme Court ruled that it was unlawful for this company, it was called Arrow, A-E-R-E-O, that was an internet startup, to basically, what they were doing was they were capturing broadcast television signals. They had these antennas, were capturing the broadcast signals, and then were essentially repackaging those and streaming those over the internet to their subscribers. Now, you know, in the past, the court has not been, that's been fairly wary of trying to shut down disruptive technologies. But I think the classic example of that is back in 1984 when you first started having, you know, VCRs and home recording of home video recorders. You know, the court refused to block those. But in this case, they took a little bit of a different tactic and essentially ruled that it was a violation of copyright law. I found this particular decision to be a little bit troubling because the broadcast companies, they put together the broadcasts, they're transmitting them over the public airwaves, and so why is it a violation of copyright law for a private company to essentially take those signals that are being broadcast out there for everyone and simply repackage those in the way that it wants and selling it to subscribers. In my view, to me, it seems like the court here was simply protecting, protecting the big media companies. And what I found interesting was that this was a 6-3 decision by the Supreme Court, with the three most conservative judges, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, actually coming down on the side of the technology company in the minority. I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but this is one where I'm almost thinking that that the majority of the court here, the liberal wing, is really protecting media monopolies, and I think maybe that that the extreme conservatives on the court may have actually had this one right. Thoughts on that?
Very few. I think we need to get an intellectual property guy in here to defend the copyright laws.
Well, we're kind of reaching the end of the hour here, so we probably ought to think about wrapping up here fairly soon. But there were just a couple of other decisions that were there. There was a big case involving the EPA, where the court upheld the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases. That was utility air versus EPA. The other big one that actually dealt with the death penalty, which I wish we'd have more time to get into, and maybe we can do another show on this down the road, was Hall versus Florida. And that was where the court rejected sort of a mechanical test that the state of Florida had over executing individuals who had a certain IQ. Can you maybe just in a nutshell, in the last couple of minutes we have remaining here, Eric, tell us a little bit about that case?
Right. Well, over the last few decades, the Supreme Court has been recognizing that society has some limits to what we're willing to allow the death penalty to be used for. And so basically, the Supreme Court says we can no longer kill kids and we can no longer kill people who are insane or who have mental challenges, significant mental challenges. I mean, one of the classic cases you hear about the prisoner who's on his way, who's having his last meal and wraps up the brownie that he got for his last meal, and the guards ask him why he's wrapping up his brownie, and he says, so that I can have it later. People that are that challenged mentally, the Supreme Court has said we shouldn't be killing them because they just don't understand what's going on. It's just not right and fair and just in America today. So what Florida did is Florida took one of the more recent decisions that held that and said, all right, we're just going to say if you've got an IQ above 70, we can kill you. And so this challenge was, this guy had a IQ dependent on, he had three or four different findings. Some doctors said 69, one doctor said 71, one doctor said 74, something like that. And Florida said, well, good enough. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, that law is just too rigid. The courts need to look at the whole picture. They can't just look at one number and say, go ahead and kill him.
So ultimately, a good death penalty decision then by the Supreme Court for death penalty
if there is such
oppositions.
Thing.
Well,
yeah.
True.
Right.
Well, you've been listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio station. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild, and I've had with me today Eric Vernon, a local criminal defense attorney, and we've been giving you a little bit of a wrap-up of some of the more important legal developments that occurred during the last year. A lot more to get into, but unfortunately the hour's over, and we're going to have to go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to go ahead and thank our engineer today, Mike Murphy, who is actually standing in for Beth Pike, to whom we wish a speedy recovery, and Tune in next Monday one more time to listen to Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following report, courtesy Tampa Bay Times.
On May 27th at around 7:30 in the evening, Israel Reyes's life changed forever. Reyes had fallen asleep on the couch in his living room while his boyfriend, Jason Westcott, watched TV in the bedroom.
And the next thing I know is being dragged off the couch by the SWAT team, being thrown onto the ground.
SWAT team, he's live on West Norwood Street to explain.
29-year-old Jason Westcott came out of a room armed.
This was the scene in May. Drugs, guns, and the SWAT team.
The next thing I know, I hear five gunshots, boom, 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 boom. And I get out the grip of the officer that had my face on the ground and look to the right, and seen all the blood spatter dripping down the bathroom wall.
Authorities accused Westcott and Reyes of selling marijuana out of their home on multiple occasions. During the raid, police said Westcott raised his gun in a threatening manner and shot him three times. Jason Westcott died during the ambulance ride to the hospital.
He was always outspoken, always had a joke to tell. You know, he could make anybody laugh. He was able to talk to anybody, no matter where you came from or who you were, what color you were. He was just very friendly and very personable.
Despite a four-month-long investigation by Tampa police, the SWAT team found only 0.2 grams, or about $2 worth, of marijuana in the house. The drug buys that preceded the raid were conducted by this man. He is confidential informant Ronnie Kugel, who asked that his face not be filmed for security reasons.
It made no sense. The raid made no sense. I don't think the buys justified the way they went in on Jason. He wasn't a hardened criminal. He was involved in selling grams of pot to smoke, so he could smoke pot, and they knew this information.
A 50-year-old felon and drug addict, Kugel has been in and out of jail on a steady stream of charges for the past two decades. He now says he lied or made up much of the information police used to build cases against drug suspects like Westcott.
Tell us what information you made up or exaggerated about Jason Westcott specifically.
Specifically, the amount, I think, of pot I saw and maybe a firearm. I think I told him one time I saw two firearms, and I don't think I ever saw two firearms.
Well, I've heard it said that snitches get stitches, but you see, sometimes snitches get riches. Please be sure to tune in tomorrow. We'll have part two of this report, courtesy of the Tampa Bay Times. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
I can. And if I fall down, I'm gonna get back up. It'll be alright. It'll be okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Gonna keep that smile on my face. Gonna teach myself how to understand.